For the week of April 19th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 490, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at my local Transcendental Meditation Center, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't even know what you're referring to by transcendental meditation. I mean, I know what it is, but I don't know why you're mentioning that now.
Well, I love it because the Hollywood Reporter is interviewing people and saying, how are you dealing? What are you doing? And recently they posted an interview with director David Lynch, who of course touted the benefits of TM, which he's been a big proponent of for many years, that it will make you happy. You can go internal. It'll help you. But the very first question was, like they asked of everyone, how are you adjusting to the current situation? And David Lynch said, very well. I like isolation.
Yeah, that does not shock me.
That sounds like David Lynch.
It most certainly does. Now, you know, speaking of interviewing people, I think that we should maybe take people a little bit behind the scenes or like show them into our sausage kitchen. Ooh. And tell them how we make the show. Normally, we record on Monday mornings and we'll kind of do the show in order and we'll get the guests to show up like midway through whenever their segment is. But this week, we actually recorded beforehand. We recorded the Kelly McBride, who we'll be talking to later from the Poynter Institute. We recorded her on Friday and it was an amazing conversation.
Well, and it's a little long. So as usual, our show is meaty, beady, big and bouncy. You know, it's a big full meal. And since you're in isolation, you're going to love listening to all of it. So we hope you stick forward and listen to all of it and dive into that conversation. But what else are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still socially distancing physically, obviously, but our podcast will continue to whisper in your ears. I don't know why every time I read that line, I want to go ASMR. Uh-huh. Anyway, we're going to be whispering about the latest entertainment news, including this week's video on demand charts and the ripple effects of the pandemic.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not in stereo. That would be even better.
All right.
Now, after tackling the future of movies and theater in the post-pandemic world, we did that in previous episodes. Today, we'll focus on journalism. And as we mentioned, our guest is going to be Kelly McBride, the senior vice president at the Poynter Institute and the new public editor for National Public Radio. She'll discuss the importance of an ombudsperson at major media outlets, including The Hollywood Reporter, by the way. She's going to talk about the work of the Poynter Institute, the future of journalism and media ethics as it applies to everything from the debate over presidential press conferences to the recent shakeup at The Hollywood Reporter, where, of course, she advises. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss a few of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in. I want to say it's on last week's video on demand charts, but I think it's actually last 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, video on demand charts.
That's right. If you're wondering where Trolls World Tour is, that didn't happen until next week. So we are covering the week of April 6th through the 12th, which means that opening weekend of April 6th, 7th, 8th, that's a week before Trolls World Tour came out. So we'll have to see where that places on the chart. Though I am noticing that The Invisible Man is not on this chart. So I'm wondering how well that did. Remember, Fandango Now told us last week, oh, Trolls World Tour set a record for our pre-orders and all of this. And we're like, yeah, who goes to Fandango Now? And they said our previous record holder was The Invisible Man, that movie starring Elizabeth Moss. Well, that didn't make the top 10. So again, what we're looking at here is a ranking of what we are told are the most popular movies on video on demand. These are things that you are renting, usually for about $3 or $5 for 48 hours. Some of them are premium video on demand, so they might cost $20. But this is what we're looking at. We don't know what they're grossing, but we do know these are the most popular. And the most popular film in homes the week of April 6th was The Call of the Wild, the Harrison Ford flick from Fox. That's at number one. And number two is Harley Quinn, or as the official title is, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. That's at number two. So a little bit of activity going on this week. And number three is Little Women from Sony. And number four is a Universal film, Doolittle, still right in the top five there. And at number five is Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker. Below that is 1917. And then Onward, the Disney film that is available on Disney Plus, that Pixar movie. I'm going to check it out. And number eight
is it available on Disney Plus? I think it's only available premium VOD.
No, it's premium VOD, or if you're a Disney Plus owner, it's available on Disney Plus because they were advertising it as such. I didn't actually go there to look at it. Maybe it's not available at this minute, but I thought...
I don't think it is. Frozen 2, however, they did bring back early.
Right. I believe Onward is available on Disney Plus. I'm at the wrong house to go check, or I would do that right now. If you can turn on your TV and find out, do it. Meanwhile, at number 8 is Jumanji, The Next Level. At number 9 is Just Mercy. And number 10 is Knives Out. That means everyone is sick and tired of watching Contagion to find out how awful it could be. They're like, we know how awful it can be. We're here right now.
Actually, I can tell you, it is now on Disney Plus.
That's what I thought.
As of April 3rd.
All right. Well, you know, that's just one of the latest little bits of information we have. But we do have more updates on the coronavirus and the pandemic and how it's affecting the entertainment business.
Well, where do you want to start? I mean, Book Expo and Book Con have been canceled.
Well, I mean, you know, every major publisher pulled out before they finally said, okay, yeah, there's not going to be a show. they really stuck it out. They really were bitterly holding on and hoping they could do it. But, you know, nobody was coming. So they really had to
that might be partially due to the way their force majeure insurance clause works, where it's like they have to wait till a certain point where they go, oh, now it's force majeure, you know. And the same thing is true with like the Ultrafest, the music festival in Miami. They needed Miami to cancel it. They couldn't cancel it.
That's right. Well, Khan said they are going to go forward with their virtual film market, and lots of major players are going to be involved in that. That will happen in June. Online, obviously. And Sperling, you were right. I was wrong. Khan has said, yes, we are looking towards tagging movies as not as official selections of Khan, because that can't happen, but saying we love these movies, we've seen them, we want to celebrate them, and we're going to tag them something like Khan 2020, meaning these are movies we want to celebrate and support. They're really saying, you know, this is what we do. We celebrate movies. We give them that stamp of approval and say we've seen them and we love them. We want everybody else to see them too. And we think that has value, even if the Cannes Film Festival doesn't take place.
And there's been some talk about maybe perhaps Venice and Cannes teaming up to do a festival in September. I don't know how that would work. Maybe both cities.
Venice says, well, we're going forward in September and there's no collaboration with Cannes because they don't talk to us, you know?
When, yeah.
He said, I keep reaching out. He's like, well, we're thinking about it. It was like, well, we got to get going. And they somehow believe they're going to go forward in September. They say clearly there will be very little international presence, they assume. They're working out how to do it. And they're saying, look, opening up all the movie theaters is not possible, but opening 6 or 7 and having it in a controlled way so we can have these screenings and have journalists, at least from Europe there, we believe we can do that safely. And we're going to work with the city and to make sure we do that.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine any movie stars, being allowed to go, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well, in London, they're insisting that the West End is going to reopen. It stayed open during most of the Blitz during World War II. Some shows were still going on, you know, amidst the possibilities of bombing, and West End is saying, we're not going to be shut down now. And they're saying, look, come back in the fall, book in November. They're bringing back shows like A Christmas Carol, which they had just staged, and that very popular staging is coming back to London in November, and they're ready to take your money and book tickets. But and in Seoul, South Korea, Phantom of the Opera plans to reopen this week. Now, in Seoul, they've done a great job with testing. They've done a great job with limiting the spread of the virus and being ready to catch new breakouts as they occur. So they believe they can start to reopen business. But before you can do that, you need a lot of testing ready to go, which the UK certainly does not have and the US does not have. But
I just saw Phantom of the Opera over the weekend on YouTube, the Andrew Lloyd Webber production from the Royal Albert Hall. The 25th anniversary production was free on YouTube.
That's right. But a lot of countries seem to be wanting to get back to business. It's been a month. They're going crazy. They're worried about the economy, but they're not recognizing the long-term health of the economy depends on people not dying. It's not actually good for the economy when you open up too soon, but we're seeing surges in red states. Every state that has not done social distancing, the 8 or 9 states, those are where all the big spikes in new cases are occurring in the U.S. this week. And state governments like Alabama and Florida and others are saying, we got to get back to work. We got to get back to work. But we don't have remotely the testing we need in order to do that properly. You have a shutdown. And then when you go back, to some minimal socialization and minimal businesses reopening, that's in hand with testing. So if something flares up, you can contact trace, you can get in there right away. You've got a big sample of the large population, so you know where your problems are, and you can swoop in and make sure you isolate those people and get them to quarantine. But we're not ready for that. We don't have remotely the testing we need. So I mean, I know Alabama, they're going to start things up in May 1st. The governor hasn't spoken yet, but they've already sent out information on, you know, nail salons and spas and stores and restaurants and what they're going to need to do. So they're not going to say just open up and do whatever you want. But without testing, I don't understand how it can happen at all. There's going to be a lot more cases and people dying if they do this too soon.
Now, I know even as we're talking here, we're getting announcements about release schedule updates. And as we said, Michael, we've said this on previous episodes, that basically studios are now running around like the Homestead Act, you know, where in the 1800s, where you could get 160 acres of land in the U.S.
if you planted your flag first.
Right. So now everybody's running around going, oh, the Batman? Warner Brothers is like, no, June 25th, 2021, nobody released anything on that date.
It's more like musical chairs or fantasy baseball, because this is all pure supposition. They're not going to be able to open up in the fall, which means they don't know what dates they're going to be able to open up movie theaters. So right. Every date they announce is going to have a cascading effect when something has to move forward a month. Come, you know, a month or two when we have a better idea. So I feel it's more like musical. You know, they're just running around trying to find a seat, trying to stop, you know, find that seat before the music stops. They're going to keep playing for months to come, I think. So I don't think they can have any real idea. Though obviously movie theaters can do social distancing. Unlike Broadway and the West End, you can't open a house and have 50% capacity. You can't have every other seat full, because A, you'd have to have every third seat full, because that's how you'd have at least some distancing, because one seat isn't much. In a Broadway house, they're very close together, and nobody can make money on half full houses. And maybe if you charged $500 a ticket, you could conceivably have Hamilton and the Book of Mormon open, but most shows are going to lose money at 50% capacity, or certainly 30% capacity. They don't make money, because you got to have all the people on stage there. It's not any cheaper to open the show. But a movie theater, you know, they can get money trickling in. They can get people going back to the movies. You know, movies can have a third of the seats full, and that's some money. It doesn't cost them any more to open up the house, right? However, no. My question to you is, what does that do for windowing? When everybody is so anxious, the studios, for some reason, think 12 weeks is this eternity, which I don't agree with anymore. I think it's pretty darn quick. But if you have half capacity, you're not going to want to bring movies out on, you know, in 12 weeks. Well, maybe you want to wait and get all that money that you can get at the theater. You know, if you've got a $200 million movie, maybe you're going to want to extend the window and say, 12 weeks might be a little too soon, because we're at half capacity and we're sold out. And people are flocking to the theater. So maybe we've got, you know, it's going to take us twice as long to make the money we could. Maybe we shouldn't be in such a rush.
Yeah, I have a feeling you're going to see, well, studios kind of testing the water with smaller titles or titles that aren't their tent poles, mainly just to see, okay, yeah, what we have an estimate of what we thought this would make under normal circumstances. How much can it actually make, given that, you know, we're only selling 50% of the tickets? And then if you were to look at what Cinemark said, because they went into the debt market, they're going to raise $250 million.
We should do that.
Yes, I agree. A quarter of a billion dollars, I think we could get by.
Oh, no. With small business, $10 million, let's do it.
Okay, well, they basically said, you know, normally you can never get these figures, which is the, mm-hmm, what is your occupancy rate? Like, what do you, ooh, normally have? They would never be willing to tell you. But since they're kind of going out and raising money, they have to say, well, look, we'll be fine. Even if we can only sell 50% of the tickets, we'll be fine. Look, in good times, we could, you know, our occupancy rate is only 20 to 30%. Oh, and that's when we're doing really well.
That's deeply misleading.
I totally agree, because they're basically saying that, yes, when you count Tuesday at 11 a.m., yes, there's three people in the audience. For the film, where on Friday at 7 p.m., you had 150 people in a 151-seat auditorium.
Right. I mean, there's 5-6 shows a day, maybe 7 for some movies, and they are not at full. They are not winning with 30% capacity. They're winning when they're 80, 90% capacity in prime time.
Correct.
And people are not necessarily going to be ready or available to go at 2 p.m. on a weekday, though. Maybe they will in the new world we live in if they're not getting back to work. So, yeah, that's a big issue. And again, parents with kids, that's a big issue, because how can you go back to work if one of you has to stay home because you have kids? They're not going anywhere till September.
Well, you know, actually, you know where we're not going this year?
Where?
San Diego for Comic-Con in July.
Oh, that's all canceled. Everything is canceled. Everything is canceled.
I just got a note here. 2020, the year, canceled, actually.
Well, and you know, the kids are probably playing video games and stuff like Animal Crossing, which is hugely popular. I have friends who are playing it. It's the latest fad. It's making Switch very popular. Is it Switch or Twitch? What's it called?
Wait, it depends. They're both.
Uh-oh. They're both things?
Switch is the actual console, the actual video game unit. The Twitch is the streaming platform, which I did try to watch. There was an article in the New York Times about like one or two very popular Twitch streamers, and they stream all day long, like 8 hours a day. Like it's a job for them.
Yeah,
they have millions of people.
Yeah.
I tuned in, I signed up for an account. I watched for like 10 minutes and I thought, I have no idea what I am looking at. This is like, who are they talking to? Like, what is going on? There's like the chat is scrolling up the side with
what's this rock and roll music? It's just a bunch of noise. I'm an old
man. Get off of my lawn.
Yeah. Anyway, Animal Crossing is hugely popular all over the world right now. It's doing great, except in China, because China has not approved Animal Crossing yet for that country. They tend to turn the other way in the old days and say, all right, you're getting it through there on the gray market. We'll ignore that because we want to let a little release fall. We have a totalitarian state and we want people to feel like they can get some of the things they want and thus not rebel. So they tended to look the other way when things like that happened. However, they have really banned it now because Hong Kong protesters and other people around the world were starting to put up banners on their own virtual islands saying, free Hong Kong, revolution now. And people could visit those islands and see the protests and that people are still angry and upset and want their freedom. And so China said, boom, no Animal Crossing for you. So they have really clamped down on that game. That's not happening anywhere in China right now, as best as they can stop it.
Well, and I know we talked about Matt Bellany in the past.
That's right.
I got the name right that time, by
good
the
job,
way.
Good have you job. Noticed?
Yeah. And there were layoffs, even more layoffs at The Hollywood Reporter, Billboard, and Dick Clark Productions just last week. And layoffs are never easy to talk about. They're never nice. But what surprised me is that The Hollywood Reporter said they were losing money for tens of millions of dollars
surprising.
Per year.
We've known that.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. We've discussed this before. Yeah, they've been losing money for years, trying to turn it around and make it into a money earning proposition that hasn't been happening. So they said these layoffs were happening. The pandemic just accelerated what we were going to do, but it's bad. I mean, Todd McCarthy's out at Hollywood Reporter. He's you feel like when people like Todd McCarthy or Robert Christgau at Village Voice lose their jobs, you think, oh my God, no wonder I don't have a job. if they're not keeping a job, I'm certainly not keeping a job. But speaking of the Hollywood Reporter, we talked about them because of
we should point out who Todd McCarthy is.
The top film critic at the Hollywood Reporter. Okay. Everybody listening to this podcast knows who Todd McCarthy is. But you're right, we should identify everyone. But we should also identify the fact that we're going to speak to somebody who has a connection to the Hollywood Reporter right now, and that is Kelly McBride of Poynter Institute.
Well, yes, Michael, as you mentioned, today we are joined by Kelly McBride, the Senior Vice President of the Poynter Institute and the Chair of its Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership. Kelly McBride just got a new gig as well. She's the Public Editor for National Public Radio. Her career has been devoted to supporting journalism around the world while encouraging the industry to meet the highest standards in its work. Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kelly, before we step into the work you do at the Poynter Institute, your new position at NPR, and all the great stuff you guys are doing there, we wanted to step back for a second. We've been speaking to experts in film and theater about the pandemic, the challenges everyone faces, and what life is going to be like when we get back to semi-normal. And before the pandemic, local journalism in particular was facing a major crisis. We're familiar with food deserts. And with now healthcare deserts, people who have hospitals who are half an hour or an hour away. And I think we can obviously for years now be talking about journalism deserts, especially at the local level. A lot of communities in this country do not have a local newspaper with the resources to do independent journalism. They don't have a local radio station with reporters on staff who can do more than repeat the weather and show up at openings, and they don't have a local TV station, especially if it's owned by Sinclair. So a local TV station that's going to do local independent journalism. There's no one at the local level in a lot of communities for someone to represent the people, someone to go to City Hall, ask the questions of the mayor and the chief of police and all this stuff. And we've seen this for years for a lot of reasons. And now with this pandemic, I feel like people have been saying newspapers are dinosaurs. And now the meteorite has just slammed into the planet and it may be an extinction level event. Am I too pessimistic here?
No, this is a crisis. This is an absolute crisis. There are many, many local news organizations that are not going to make it through what we're looking at right now. You know, the Poynter Institute owns a newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times, and we had to reduce the number of days that we print down to 2 days a week.
Oh, my gosh.
And because suddenly what you see is advertising drops off immediately and precipitously. And so you're really faced with taking out more loans, which is not an option for most news organizations, or reducing your expenses. And we're seeing news organizations all across the country reduce expenses in the form of manpower through layoffs and furloughs. We felt like it would be better to preserve our reporting capacity and reduce the delivery because we know that people can get to the news. So we still produce news 7 days a week. We just don't deliver it on paper to everybody's doorstep all 7 days. We only deliver it 2 days a week. And we felt like that was the best business model. But you're going to see many news organizations, and it's going to come across the board, right? So broadcast has seen a hit to their advertising. For-profit print newspapers have seen a hit to their advertising. And then nonprofit, right? Public radio and other nonprofit startups, they make a lot of revenue off of events and sponsorships. And both of those have just completely tanked. So it's going to be, we're never going back, right? We are never going back to where we were in journalism before the pandemic hit.
And that wasn't good.
right. And that was, we were still like almost on life support at that point. The good thing is, I think we were going to travel this path anyway in local journalism. This just accelerated by about 5 years, the path that we were going to travel. And so it's really forcing us in local journalism in particular to really imagine what the future looks like when advertising is not the main supporter of our work, which means reader revenue, right? Subscriptions. And you're seeing many news organizations see a bump in both traffic. And those who are doing it right are getting a bump in subscriptions. And my colleague, Rick Edmonds, wrote a really great piece on Poynter.org that did the highlights of five experts in that field. Four of them are people that don't usually get quoted in these watching the media news articles. And so there is a silver lining or a bright spot in there, but it's a pretty dark cloud right now.
Well, I'm almost tempted to say, you mean that CNN is not getting paid for all those ASPCA commercials they're running? That's shocking.
They may be getting like 10 cents on the dollar. I don't know what the real number is, but it's not what they were normally charging.
Yeah, well, maybe they're being paid in puppies. I don't know.
What is the model for the future? Because we know we can't depend on journalism being a hobby of billionaires. That's simply not a viable model.
Right. So I do think that reader revenue in some form, it's either going to be subscriptions or memberships or some sort of combination of advertising will play an increasingly smaller role in funding journalism.
Do you see publicly funding journalism? And we have some of that now, of course, but do you see it at a more big level across the country for local media?
Yeah. In fact, I think that it was a huge, huge step that almost every news organization in the country applied for available loans from the government that will eventually be forgiven. So I think what you're going to see is first this step, right? We'll take the one-time bailout. And then you're going to see lobbyists start to ask for a more sustained level of support. And that could come in a million different forms. Steve Waldman had a very, very good article in CJR that reviewed lots of great ideas, including government mandated advertising, right? Like the census has something like $1 billion targeted for advertising. The government could say you have to buy that advertising in local news organizations to support local news. You could see something like the National Academy of Science started for, we already have an arts endowment, right? You could see that expanded to include journalism. And then you could also see some form of direct subsidies. This was unthinkable 10 years ago when we were in crisis still. But now you're starting to see many news organizations say, there's really not a future for local journalism if there isn't some sort of sustained support, either from the government or from the community itself.
Well, CJR, we should point out, is the Columbia Journalism Review, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
I guess, you know, whenever we have, specifically, I'm in Los Angeles, but whenever we have guests on from the LA Times and I tell them that, you know, I read their stuff every day in the newspaper that lands at the end of my driveway, they're shocked that I'm getting a print version of their newspaper. And I still get it. And I know they had some layoffs in their business section, probably ad sales reps, and administrative personnel just this past week because advertising did plummet. And, you know, there's no sports section anymore. It's kind of buried in the local news section. And, you know, but I can only do so much. I can only get one subscription. I can't get 50 subscriptions.
That's not true. You could, in fact, get 50 prescriptions. You know, you could get 50 peppers delivered to your house every day.
Well, you could buy them as gifts.
Oh, actually, that's not a bad idea.
I know, it's a great idea. I've done it for all my kids.
And I have no money. So, you know, Perling, Christmas is done.
Why that is.
That's journalism again. So now media ethics is always a hot topic. Stuff that you have covered recently on the Poynter Institute website, articles that you've written include exactly that, a story about when news organizations apply for federal funds to keep their business alive. What does that mean ethically? Do media outlets have a moral duty to make their coronavirus coverage free for all and not hide it behind a paywall? And stuff that we've been covering via Me Too, you have been discussing for decades, how to cover rape and sexual harassment and Me Too, the changing standards that we have and why that's a good thing. And you've done everything from writing about, you know, whether to name rape victims to developing workshops for training newsroom staff on sexual harassment in the workplace, as well as how you cover it. And that's a program I think is called Press Forward. And even recently, you were discussing the Kobe Bryant legacy and how sports journalism failed in its coverage of Bryant for years before he died. And that's something we dealt with here because I had an aneurysm while Kobe Bryant was alive and campaigning to get and actually win an Oscar for a very bad animated film he made, which celebrated him and his love of basketball. And all the LA people who, of course, love his team and they brought him a championship, they didn't care and didn't want to hear about the unpleasant fact that he was credibly accused of assault and rape. They just didn't want to hear it, refused to hear it, and gave him their highest honor. So my head explodes every week here on the show when it comes to that sort of stuff.
That is, I can actually testify, that is true. We're not video, but if we were, it would be kind of a Michael Bay film every week.
So that's what you cover all the time. So explain to people who don't know what the Poynter Institute is.
Yeah, so we've been around for 40 years. We are a nonprofit training center, and our mission is to elevate journalism in service of democracy. We serve journalists the world over. We work sometimes in emerging democracies, and that's fairly controversial. Some people think that unless you have some sort of government protections for a free press, other journalists shouldn't be trying to advance your profession in different countries. But our belief is that citizens cannot self-govern if they don't have good, healthy information about the community in which they live and the government that serves them and the leaders that they participate in electing. So, we do training. We work directly with news organizations. We go in and do workshops for them. We do consulting. We write ethics policies. I've written a lot of ethics policies. Probably
cut and paste, I hope, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we charge. Not everybody can pay, and we charge a sliding scale. And the, you know, Craig Newmark created the Center for Ethics and Leadership at the Poynter Institute specifically so that we could offer sliding scale fees. We charge those who can pay. We work with those who need a little bit of assistance. And we do a lot of free work too, right? Like I take probably between 5 and 10 calls a week from journalists who are stuck on a very specific story where there's an ethical dilemma. And I do that because it's a way of keeping in touch with the industry. But I have colleagues who cover the news at Poynter.org. We have a handful of reporters who are very expert in what's going on. I have colleagues who have expertise in leadership, in writing, in diversity, in broadcast journalism, in visual journalism. And then we have an online training center where we do online training as well called News University. So we have, like, and then we also have, I almost forgot, we have a couple of new divisions. So PolitiFact, which you've probably heard of, it lives at the Poynter Institute. It is one of the original fact-checking organizations founded in 2008, actually 2007, in the run-up to the 2008 election, winner of a Pulitzer Prize. And we also have a division that's very similar to PolitiFact called MediaWise, and they essentially do fact-checking on distributed platforms like TikTok and Instagram for teens to teach them to be media literate.
Yeah, you're reaching the kids, like Linda Ellerbe.
we actually get requests from the AARP to do the same thing for them. So
please, God.
We know that more than just teens are looking at that information.
And I tell my mom, you can't watch the local news. You'd have to turn this off because we have a Sinclair station here. Anyway.
Yeah, and then we have one more thing, and that is the International Fact Checking Network is also located at the Poynter Institute. So that's all the fact checkers from the world over, their professional association.
Let me kick off for just a second, Sperling. I love fact checking. Just by sheer luck, I came to New York wanting to work in entertainment journalism, and I got a job at Premier Magazine, which had a very rigorous fact-checking department. And just by luck, after starting in the photo department, I got my actual internship, unpaid, of course, and job working in the fact-checking department. I'd never taken a journalism class. I worked at the school newspaper in college, but I'd never taken a journalism class, never taken a fact-checking class. And I was rigorously trained in fact-checking from day one there and got a great education. Their goal was to be as good as the New Yorker, and they really had an excellent reputation for many years while they were around. So that training was unbelievable for me, and every single journalist should have. I'm sure they do at least a little fact checking, but that should just be a constant in your career. That should be the base of everything that you do. It was so great for me to deal with other people's articles and go, "How do you know? How do you know? What is the context?" Well, but yes, but have you gone back to the grave and read the stone yourself? Or were you, you know? So that was just unbelievable for me. I loved it so much. It's been great. And I've been saying for years, you know, we got to teach like high school kids how to fact check. I mean, and we also, so they can look at media critically, because fact checking allows you to say, wait, what is this source I'm looking at online? As someone posted an article on Facebook, but I've never heard of this. Why would I listen to them? Who are they? Who funds them? Or can I not even find anything about them? And that's exactly what you guys have been doing. You have been taking fact-checking to kids in high schools. And I'm like, oh my God, thank you. So that's the sort of stuff that you guys are doing all the time, isn't it?
Have you read Lifespan of a Fact?
I have not. Oh yes, I saw the play, and then I read the book afterwards.
It's really good. The book, I read the book.
It's much better.
And it's just, it's so amazing to think about. I remember as a young journalist, an editor taking a printout of my story and highlighting every assertion that I made. And he called it prosecuting the story. And he would make me defend every assertion that I made. Because as you read news, you realize that there are a lot of assertions that are just made as if they are well-known facts. And that's part of the authority of being a journalist is you can do that, but you're supposed to have the reporting behind it. And that was, as like a 21-year-old, an editor taught me how to do that. And I can't even write a note to my mom now without doing the same thing. That dinner was lovely, right?
Was it?
Was it really? Yeah.
What's the right synonym, right adjective for that? I'm tempted to make a joke about, only being able to afford, college being so expensive, I'm only able to afford a 2-year degree or to go to college for 2 years. So I specialize in alternative facts. But that would be a sad truth given the current state. And speaking of which, all joking aside, and actually, no, this would kind of be true. You've been probably pretty busy over the last, 3.5 years.
Yeah. I mean, actually, ever since I've been at Poynter, I worked in local news for 15 years, and then I came to Poynter about 18 years ago. Ever since I've been at Poynter, I've been pretty busy. Literally, I got here in 2002, and in 2003, Jason Blair in the New York Times happened, right? So to refresh everybody's memory, Jason Blair was a reporter who plagiarized and fabricated a bunch of stuff that was published in the New York Times and was eventually exposed, and the investigation found dozens and dozens of stories. That was the original sort of travesty that I built my career on. Every time something like that happens, there are a number of systems in journalism that have failed in order for that to happen, right? It's not like journalism is perfect and will never make mistakes, but there are systems in place to correct those mistakes when they're made, and ideally to catch them before they're actually broadcast or published. Ever since 2002, I have been plenty busy. I don't remember it not being busy for someone in my line of work.
And now you're working with NPR, so you're going to be even busier. Although, I guess I should ask, do they force you to have like great audio and great sound and to make it sound like you're whispering into?
They do have training for speaking. Not that you would need that, but they do, don't they?
They have training for everything, and they take their sound very seriously. It makes it enjoyable, right? Good sound is important. Is an important quality for the storytelling. Now that they're all working from home, they're actually learning how to do the best that they can. But they're also they also know that the story is more important than the sound, and so they're making some concessions too. But I mean, my job at NPR is to look at the product as a consumer would look at the product, and to ask, are you really serving the audience? And are you serving both the audience that you have, which for NPR is a pretty loyal audience, but also pretty educated, pretty white audience right now. And also, are you serving the audience that you aspire to have because it's the democratically appropriate thing to do? And
because the majority of people are people of color in about a year or two. So, if you want to reach the majority of Americans, you better reach out beyond the white audience.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is a challenge. They're very self-aware. It is a goal from the highest level throughout the entire organization. And my job is to hold them accountable to their aspirations.
Now, it's not just you, however. It's a team of people at Poynter, because NPR has a ton of coverage that goes out every day. And it's not going to be just you trying to run down items and see, responding to people. You're going to have a group of people behind you working to deal with the mass of feedback and criticism and opinions that NPR receives every day, aren't you?
Yes, I have. I will have a researcher at Poynter. Plus, I have all of my colleagues at Poynter to tap into. And that is really helpful, because a lot of times when you're presented with a big issue, like whether you should name a sexual assault victim, it is really helpful to have the number of journalists that we have at Poynter, who are all incredibly thoughtful and experienced, thinking through issues with me. So yeah, I have a lot of people at Poynter to help me. And then I also have a researcher at NPR to help me. So there's a pretty big team that I get to stand in front of. It's a lovely, privileged position to be in.
The other day I was listening to NPR, and Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina was being interviewed about, I guess, COVID-19 and his state's response to it. And, NPR gets some flack for being a liberal or, non-Republican or kind of bashing Republicans. I'm not using the right verbiage here,
But the based host, in facts.
Based, yeah, based in, okay, yeah, that is the right, they really are very fact-based, thankfully. Tim Scott was being interviewed, and the host mentioned in closing, like kind of forgot to mention that he had written a book, and so thanked Tim Scott for being there and said, and we should mention that Tim Scott's new book, said the name of the book, which I can't remember, is available. And he then went, it's available, like in a very salesy pitch, went, it's available wherever books are sold. And and the host was just like, yeah, okay, thank you. Just the way he said it, I just thought, yeah, because it was precisely what, after this very serious interview about coronavirus and the deaths and how his state didn't close down early and now is kind of facing this big problem. And like, then he went right into sales mode and it was like, oh, you are a politician. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, I don't think people really remember, that's probably the way to put it, what a public editor or ombudsperson is. The New York Times shamefully does not have one anymore. They had a great one and they dumped them. And I find that indefensible. But it's hard to, this is a person who is there to get feedback from readers or people who are the subjects of stories when they feel they're unhappy with it, or they think it should have been different, or they, why did they do this? Why did they do that? So it's partially you being transparent with NPR and saying, here's how this story came about, here's why they did this. It's also partly sometimes a corrective where you can say, they could have done a better job with this or this, or you say, no, they did a good job and this is why. How do you avoid the people, the journalists that you're working with, not feeling like you're just trying to play gotcha all the time? Because it is a you know, a challenging dynamic. They want to see what's on their side, but you have to be that independent voice that can criticize and speak out.
Yeah, I mean, independence is really important. The best public editors have ultimate independence, which I do. The way the contract and the charter is written, while I report to the CEO, he can't fire me. He can't hold any of my columns. I have, and historically, I've talked to everybody who's done the job. There's no interference. It is, Margaret Sullivan, I believe, said it was one of the loneliest jobs that she ever did. you are constantly with your colleagues, right? The people that work for the same organization than you, your job is to scrutinize what they do. So it's it can make for, I think, difficult relationships. I think the challenge is to build the relationships from the get-go. And then also to not self-censor. So, you would end up self-censoring if you didn't have a lot of confidence, which I do have, right? Like, I've been around for a while. That's not going to be an issue with me. But also the reason that I wanted to do it with a team from Poynter is because I want my editor, so Neil Brown, the president of Poynter, is my editor and is going to edit everything that I do. I want everybody who's working with me to be in my corner and to help me think through things, because I'm sure that there's going to come a time when something that I criticize NPR for, they will completely disagree with.
Mm-hmm. Right? Or you're not doing your job. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And I still, the reason that they want someone in this position is because they're out there hat in hand asking the public for money all the time, right? And they're saying, you should support us because we are designed to support democracy. We are designed to create a product that serves you. And the only way to really do that is to have an independent person coming behind. It's the reason that nonprofits have auditors. It's the reason that the IRS audits taxes, right? Nobody can be completely honest with themselves. And so you need that independent critic coming behind. And that's my job at NPR. Won't always be pleasant.
It will be, because if you have integrity, hopefully they will ultimately respond to that. But when they were interviewing you, did they ask you to pick out Ukraine on a map?
No. No, but that had just happened. And
you'd written a great story about it, which we have a link to on our show notes.
Oh, great. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm so flattered, actually, that you have read so much of my work. It really is a
Well, there's one important thing to keep in mind about NPR. When people think of it, they think of Fresh Air and they think of Morning Edition. But what they don't remember is that there are about 264 member stations all around the country, and they are genuinely local. A lot of their daily coverage is generated locally, and they have different flavors and different personalities, and they reflect their local community. NPR in San Francisco is not the same as an NPR station in the middle of Nebraska. And there are NPR stations in every state in this country. So you're going to be going around to the country and trying to visit some of them. Obviously, you can't visit all of them, I imagine, but you're going to be helping to reflect the fact that NPR is not this monolithic national organization. It's also a lot of independent voices, hundreds of them all over the country doing independent journalism that local people need.
Right, right. And, you know, those stations are, they're actually part of the solution to the problem that we started the conversation talking about, which is the decline in local journalism. Most NPR stations are expanding their reporting resources. And NPR is working right now to build these regional hubs. They've announced one in Texas, and there's going to be ones in other parts of the country. And those regional hubs are meant to be sort of ramped up local newsrooms that coordinate over an entire region to do the most important stories with support from the mothership for like data journalism and other more complicated, expensive projects that you couldn't do on your own from a small local station. So they really are, they recognize that problem. NPR and all the member stations recognize that problem, and they're trying to do what they can to fix it. They may not be working fast enough, but they're trying to step into that void.
Now, you're also working with, I guess, is it Valence Media, or now they've changed their name to
MRC? Yeah.
MRC Media. And just recently, there was a big issue with Matt Bellamy. I always mispronounce his name. It's Matt Bellamy, and I don't know why. I guess the first time I ever read that name, I read it as Bellamy, and now it's Matt Bellamy. He was their executive editor for a number of years. He was with the company for 14 years. Valence Media has different divisions. They have they make movies, they make television, and I guess they wanted certain coverage. Actually, nobody really knows.
Well, we didn't know what was reported. It was that he quit because they were insisting that he not cover certain companies and people who are friends of theirs critically. They also wanted him to give happy coverage to like Dick Clark Productions and all the work that they were doing. And he said, that's not how our journalism works. I can't do that. This story came out. This is why he stepped down. And some of the coverage was a little confusing because clearly the comments came from the execs at Valence Media. They were saying, look, our demands or our requests were not unreasonable. And proof is that we had someone at the Poynter Institute with us. And that's where I first saw your name, Kelly, before I realized we had a connection. We actually have a friend in common, which I didn't realize when I started to reach out and try to set up an interview with you. And I didn't use that to try and get the interview. So we got this purely, and I had no idea that you were very good friends with a very good friend of mine. It is a small world. Yes, I had no idea when I reached out to do this. And I saw your name in that story and said, huh, well, that doesn't make any sense, because no journalist worth their salt would say, well, of course you can tell me who I can cover and not cover, and that's just fine. So that was confusing, but that didn't come from you or from the Poynter Institute. That came from Valence Media trying to make their best argument about what they were doing was hunky-dory. I don't know if you can talk about that in particular. Maybe there are agreements in place, but in general, can you talk about the challenge when you are owned by a company and they are telling you, we don't want you to write negative things about this or that?
Yeah. So I actually was brought into this work almost 2 years ago.
I beg your pardon. That's when Billboard's top president was fired because he had a conflict of interest. And they said to prove that they were taking journalism seriously, they brought in the Poynter Institute to say, hey, look, we do take this seriously. We do want to have ethical standards. And that's where you first became involved. But you now want to make sure that that's not some sort of blanket, look, we're good guys because we have Poynter Institute. That is not the end of the process. That's just the beginning of it.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, I have learned a lot about the entertainment press. Certainly, over
my
the
condolences.
Last year,
it's right up there with sports journalism.
Oh my gosh, yes. And so right. Like let's. I'll give you the sort of the medium version of this story. I was brought in 2 years ago in the wake of a controversy of Billboard magazine, also owned by MRC. because a senior executive had asked that a story about a friend of his be taken down off the web. And the owners of MRC, first of all, wanted to know exactly what had happened. And then after I did that investigation and made some recommendations, what I said to them is, you have a lot of conditions here that are going to cause you to repeat these problems. One of those conditions is you don't have any of your ethics policies written down, which is not unusual in journalism, right? In fact, in my experience, maybe 40 to 50% of newsrooms don't have their policies written down, or they haven't updated them in the last 5 years, which is the same thing as not writing them down.
Or they don't have any.
Well, I mean, if you didn't have any, then you probably wouldn't want them written down, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
The point is what I found in at MRC at both the Hollywood Reporter and Billboard was that they did have a pretty good sense of journalism ethics. The people who were working at both of those organizations came from other news organizations where, right. The Wall Street Journal or magazines. Kim Masters, who works at,
he's great.
Yeah, right. So they had a pretty good solid sense of what journalism ethics should be, but they were literally passing it along as an oral tradition, which is a horrible way of doing things. So I said, let's get everything written down. And that took a while, took a couple of months. And then they kept me on as a retainer so that when problems arose, I could be there to help. Now, In my experience, that list of facts, and I'm putting air quotes around them because some of those are not facts. A lot of stuff has been reported about Matt's departure from The Hollywood Reporter that I would see from my point of view as distorted at best. And some of the things that have been reported are patently false. Every time one of those issues came up, the conversation, I never once heard any of the owners of MRC say, I don't want you to report that story. That topic is off limits. But instead, the conversation was about editorial strategy and what the editorial strategy is. And it wasn't as much that you as journalists are ticking off all of our business partners. Although that came up, right? But that was never the crux of the disagreements. The crux of the disagreements were always about when you choose one set of stories and you don't choose another set of stories, you are setting an editorial strategy. And so what I've been doing for about a year now is trying to help them set their editorial strategy. Now, editorial strategy, and this is where journalism ethics have really changed. Editorial strategy grows out of business strategy, right? You have to be able to either sell advertising or sponsorship or get readers to pay you money. You have to have a business strategy that you think will work. And in fact, they've been trying to refine that. And we're having difficulties doing it.
Reportedly, they were losing $10 million a year over the last few years with these media outlets that they had. However, they were also winning journalism awards, doing some great news coverage. From not knowing how they were doing on the bottom line, I did see that they were doing excellent journalism. And they really had turned the magazine around, Hollywood Reporter specifically, and Billboard to a degree as well, doing great journalism, at least from my reader's perspective.
And so what I hear from the owners is they want that great journalism to continue.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I can tell you, speaking from experience at Celluloid Junkie, being a trade publication, and we are very focused on a very specific side of the market, which is movie theaters, which are all closed right now. But whether you're, American Cinematographer or, the BSC magazine for British cinematographers, you have this weird tightrope you have to walk between trying to please the industry with great journalism and the fact that you could only do it if Arriflex, the camera manufacturer, takes out an ad. So if you kind of right about their most recent camera, and you kind of go, well,
yeah,
yeah, which was, yeah, well, I don't know whether it was good
no,
or
no,
bad.
No, I'm just saying in general.
And you kind of have to be honest to say, yeah, well, it kind of falls apart the moment you touch it. Well, all of a sudden they're no longer advertising.
But I mean, what you're describing though, that's access journalism, right? And a lot of journalism is access journalism. There's another layer to that. And that is that when you have a reputation for being good, the advertisers still want to advertise with you because they're not just buying your audience. They're buying the halo effect of being next to your content.
The integrity. So, yeah,
exactly. So you really do need, and I think the ad sales people at the Hollywood Reporter are really good at this. You really need an entire organization to understand what the mission is and be able to describe it to the business side, so that the business side people can describe it to their clients and customers, so that when tensions arise, the business side can say, you know, I know that you may not like this particular article. However, let's look at the long view. You're not paying us to do good coverage. You're paying us to get your product in front of this audience. And that audience isn't going to be there if we don't do the good journalism. Most of the time that argument prevails. And a lot of times when you lose advertising and this,
they come back.
It could, exactly. Right. Like it always comes back. Now the problem is that when you look at the overall chart of dollars spent on advertising, that is in a precipitous decline. Yeah. Over time. And so, So do you need a new business model if your business is advertising based? Yes. Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it when it's completely gone, or are you going to do it while you still have some runway? Those are the questions that I'm hearing in the industry.
Well, so I think what we heard here is that there's more to the story about what happened to Hollywood Reporter, but perhaps management hasn't been transparent enough or done a good enough job to reach out and be quoted to get that story across. Because as it's been reported, their side certainly has not come through in a way that you think perhaps reflects fully what went on there. But we're about to lose you, so let's go to a lightning round very quickly on one or two other topics.
Oh, I love lightning rounds. Here we go.
Absolutely. Should media outlets cover the presidential press conference live? And no, it's not enough to say we do it online as well. If you're CNN or a major outlet that can and perhaps sometimes would cover that press conference, should you cover the whole thing live?
I don't think it should preempt your primetime other coverage. That's your best opportunity to reach your audience. And I think that you can summarize later.
And right now they're cutting into all local news. It's very frustrating. So they're really cutting out the most trusted source that people have. People don't always trust their national media, though. In this time of crisis, they are flocking to the ABC Evening News and in numbers not seen in decades, for sure.
Well, what I found interesting the other day, and I know this is a lightning round, so I'll make this quick. I found interesting the other day that Trump ran this kind of like campaign ad, this kind of like cut together. And there were two networks, MSNBC and CNN, that cut away from it, which you're not really supposed to be from the federal elections laws. You're not supposed to be doing that from a government building, from the White House. And then he went on, President Trump went on to like say, I'm in total control. And that was the news story. The fact that he broke the law in front of like,
well, it wasn't officially a political ad, so it was not. He didn't break the law.
It was made by the White House staff, right? Which
they're not allowed to do political ads technically. So, White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham resigns without ever holding a single press briefing. Telling?
I'm not a political strategist, but press secretaries that don't actually talk to the press, you got to wonder what they're doing.
In that case, I'm a press secretary too.
The Poynter Institute in 2019 launched a list of news sites that they were going to say these can't be trusted. They consistently deliver false and misleading information, outlets like the Washington Times and others. And I thought that was an important thing. I think there's a very strong case to be made that once a source is on CNN and it's consistently spreading false or misleading information, you should not have them back on as a guest unless it's unavoidable because they're the president or something. So I thought that was a noble attempt. It fell apart to a degree. I don't know if that's the correct way, or it was retracted. It did not fly very well, and they weren't happy with it. But I think it was a thing worth doing, even if it's the opposite way and saying, hey, we're going to give you an annual certification of being trustworthy, even if you don't want to go the other way. Is that initiative dead, or has it been rethought, or what's happening?
Wow, you guys are really digging into our skeletons. We retracted that list. Fact checkers around the world have tried to develop a list of unreliable news sites. The reason is so that you can press your advertisers not to advertise on those sites. Problem is, one, what are the standards that you're going to use, right? Are you going to use the fact
journalist?
It's hard. It's a moving target. And even more so, the harder thing was that list was a compilation of three different research projects, drawing them in using a computer algorithm. And we didn't think it through before we published it. That's why we took it down. Our bad. Once we started looking at some of the complaints, right? Because within minutes of putting the list up, about six organizations contacted us and said, hey, why am I on this list? And when we told them, they said, well, how do we get off the list? And we didn't have a method, right? Like there wasn't a statute of limitations. If your policies had changed. So if you're going to have something like that, you need to have a staff who can adjudicate complaints in real time.
It has to be dynamic.
Right. Yeah. There are real consequences to it. And if you don't have that, if you don't have a lot of resources developed to manage that sort of list, then what's going to happen is people are going to charge you with political bias, and you're going to be undermined in the court of public opinion because you're not going to be able to defend your work. And that was exactly the position we found ourselves in. I regretted it profoundly. And we did the right thing. We took the list down and we apologized because we hadn't thought it through.
And that's what good journalism does. You don't always get things right. And the important thing is not to always be perfect, which is impossible, but to correct it in a full and transparent method that people can see you're not hiding the fact that something went wrong and that it is a noble project, but you now realize you don't have the resources to do it. You know, that's okay. You know, they can trust you when they know that if you do something and you feel it's not up to your standards, you pull it back and retract it and say, you know what? We should have done better, and we will do better next time. Your major in when you studied at
Gonzaga
was religious studies. So I want to ask you last, do you still have faith that journalism will survive?
Oh, that's a good, I like the way you worked that in, Michael. That was very good. Real time criticism.
So first, let me say Gonzaga.
Oh, there you go. Gonzaga. Thank you very much.
There you go. Obviously you guys are not basketball fans either, because
not in the least. We're like 5'6". Are you kidding me?
No, I do have faith. I'm an optimist by nature. I have faith that journalism will survive. I am not certain that it will survive as a capitalist enterprise.
Well, let me ask you this.
She's got to go. She's got to go. Yeah.
Yeah. As we part, we have a lot of industry listeners. How does the new executive editor or any editor at The Hollywood Reporter kind of say, look, we do have editorial independence, whether MRC Media comes out and has their own statement or not? How does somebody who comes in and steps into that role now say,
I'm not a patsy?
We know what's been said. However.
Sure. The first thing you do is you publish the standards, right? We worked really hard on getting those standards into shape. You publish them and you create an about page that identifies what your editorial mission is and tells your audience, here's why we exist. Here's the standards that we want you to judge us against. Most news organizations don't do that, by the way. But that is the first thing you do. The second thing you do is you develop a body of work over time. It's the only way any journalist can demand any level of credibility is over time. You bring a body of insightful, hard-hitting, interesting, entertaining, and also top level, right? Like it's gotta be, this environment is so competitive that you've gotta be better than everybody else. And when you do that, do that for a year and nobody's going to ask a question of the editor, right?
So we should have started that years ago, Sperling. But Kelly, thank you very much for joining us. We'll have links to the Poynter Institute and your new work at NPR. We hope to have you back on the show every week or at least sometime in the future.
This was so fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Well, that was great of Kelly to join us. My God, it seems like it happened days ago, and yet it just happened just now.
Just now. I mean, you'd never have. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you.
Well, so, absolutely. You know, we spoke to her on Friday. She was very generous with her time. She only got off the phone because she had another interview lined up. She's always doing conferences and meeting with groups and people and touting the importance of journalism and media ethics. She's really a big deal at the Poynter Institute and in journalism circles in general.
Yes, I'd agree.
Oh, come on.
Yes, okay. So it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the Writers Guild of America and the American Motion Picture and Television Producers Association, it's like AMPTP. Those are the studios, the people that actually hire writers and directors. Well, both of them say they will begin talks in May. Remember that little writer strike that may or may not have happened? Remember mm-hmm. that? Well, the WGA also said it would extend current contracts through mid-June while the guilds try to make a deal. It's assumed the WGA will build upon the deal the Directors Guild of America struck just last month, including a major bump in streaming money and benefits. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. Obviously, everything changed with the pandemic. Yeah, everything has ground to a halt. Nobody has any work. It's a totally different moral universe in terms of going on strike and what you're going to demand and ask for. They still deserve everything they should be getting in terms of a huge bump in residuals from streaming because that's where all the action is. They should make sure they protect their benefits. But whatever big game plan they had, it's been upended on both sides by the pandemic. Everybody's just desperately trying to see if they can keep everybody in their jobs and get the industry back at work.
Now, the mayors of New York City and Los Angeles both stated the obvious. Public events with big crowds like sports and concerts will be the last stuff to come back online. Or actually, you know, in this case, not online, but like in real life.
Unless you're going to Fortnite and, you know, going to a concert there.
Then you will be online.
Keep going.
But you'll be online in real life. But you won't actually be there because you'll be online.
Keep going.
Okay. Well, they don't see that happening, you know, all of these concerts and sporting events. They're saying, look, this ain't going to happen until about 2021.
Right. With crowds, we do believe sporting events will happen like baseball. There just won't be anyone in the stands.
I know it's a different sport. I know it's different. Start playing in Arizona. Get going.
Right. I've been watching the marble races. God, I couldn't help it. They have announcers. They have fans fighting in the stands, the little marble fans. It's hilarious. Anyway, once you've watched it for 2 minutes, you got the idea, but that was
That game Cornhole where you throw bags of little, you know, like basically bags.
Yes, I do. Though in the South, that also means something else.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm not talking about that. There is a championship for that was on ESPN. Wow, they're really pulling stuff out.
They had the Tetris World Championships, which they would air anyway, but it would air on ESPN 4 at midnight, and now it's like in prime time.
The Tetris Championships?
Oh, yeah.
I guess previously they didn't have space for that.
So anyway, we're talking about concerts. They're not going to come back until 2021.
Well, at the same time, Ticketmaster and Live Nation faced a storm of criticism for seeming to change the terms of agreement with customers. As shows got delayed for months, if not indefinitely, but not canceled, and that's important, they decided, and that is Ticketmaster decided, it would be nice to sit on the pile of money and garner the interest. At least that's what we're assuming they thought. Fans pushed back, state attorneys general started to consider officially looking into it, and the two ticket giants did an about face and decided maybe refunds were appropriate after all. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Of course, it should have happened. It's shameful of them. You know, people were being told their concert was canceled or, you know, postponed indefinitely. They didn't know when it would happen. Well, you know, it's going to be 9 months from now and you're just going to hold my money for 9 months. You know, at least offer them the option and say, hey, you've got the seat. Maybe you've got six rows center and you don't want to give your tickets back. fine. But they really got to let people know, if you do not want us to sit on the money, especially when so many people are losing their jobs, that was unconscionable. So they did say, oh, if you wanted to leave us, you can get credit of 150% of your ticket value and use it again when tickets go on sale for whatever, or we'll give you your money back. So,
well, and a part of it is also the way that, you know, ticket money is divvied up and whether they actually still have the funds or not. But
well,
still,
they got the funds because nothing happened. Yeah, nothing.
You know what they really
up.
Have is what? The insurance to cover it. So
well, they don't have to. They don't need insurance because they've got the money sitting in a bank and they give it back. So there's no losses there. That was money for shows that didn't happen and aren't happening. And some artists were saying, you know, we didn't want to, but we decided to cancel because we knew it was the only way you could get your money back. So, you know, they said, well, this is what we have to do.
Unlike airlines, some airlines like Norwegian, which does not cancel flights at all, it does not cancel the flight. The flight never takes off, but because the flight was never canceled, you never get your refund.
Yeah, I bought flight insurance for a trip to Vegas, and then Vegas, Nevada announced a state of emergency, which you think would qualify for in terms of not taking the flight, and I'm still fighting to get my money back.
Yeah, good luck. Now, Netflix stock is at an all-time high, which makes them sound...
at an all-time high.
Yeah, I was going to say, that, like that James Bond theme song, right? From, what was it, Octopussy?
That's right, with Rita Coolidge.
Yes. Well, and it definitely makes Netflix sound rich, okay? With people staying at home and binge-watching like never before, Netflix it's looking great, frankly. Sure, it's got more competition than ever, and HBO Max and Peacock are still on the way. Nonetheless, the company is now valued at $187 billion on Thursday. That was a titch more than Disney. On Friday, Disney overtook it by just another little hair, so they're going back and forth. On the other hand, maybe they should have pivoted from shipping DVDs to shipping, you know, frankly, anything, because Amazon is now valued at more than $1.1 trillion. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Like you say, it's stocks bouncing up and down in the midst of a big stock market collapse. People said, hey, we think Netflix is a great safe space. I think I don't know if it's overvalued now, but I would imagine if you say, is it worth more than Disney? That seems crazy to me, you know, because Disney has so many different elements that work so well. The parks, the movies, the TV, you know, they've got merchandise. They've got a lot of brands. And yes, some of them are taking a hit now, but that's a really short-term thinking to say, oh, the pandemic has hurt Disney parks. Of course it has, but they're going to come back, you know, long-term. That's still a great business to be in. And I feel like their diversity makes them a more valuable company, but what do I know? So Disney said, hey, that's why they're pushing Disney Plus all over the world. They like what Netflix has got. So for the moment, they're going back and forth. I would assume long-term Disney is more valuable, but Netflix is doing great, and I've felt like they've done a really good job every step of the way, and it's certainly paying off right now.
France recently had a court ruling that said Google would have to pay media companies for sharing bits of news stories in search results. Remember, we talked about it, I think it was just last week. In response, Google seemed prepared to simply, you know, stop sharing even minimal information on its search results. Now the Australian government has gone a step further. It says Google and Facebook must pay media companies when people on the site share news stories or find them via search results. Now, it's unclear how payment would be determined or if the companies can manage a workaround to avoid paying up. But as media companies teeter on the brink of bankruptcy, the government sees this as an essential step to save these media companies from extinction. We just talked about that with Kelly McBride. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop right now because it's so vague. We're not clear what exactly they're forcing them to do, how it would work, if they can avoid it, or whether they're just going to insist that they do it, and how that money would get divvied up. So until we learn more, I think it's a big whoop. It just doesn't mean much. They've got a headline, but what actually is going to happen, and can those companies avoid it? Or will they say, okay, actually, we want local media to survive? So maybe they will finally realize, you know what? We depend on the content created by that, and every darn newspaper in the country is going out of business. Maybe we should help prop that up somehow. They're not going to do it out of the goodness of their heart, but they might do it out of realizing it's important to their bottom line.
Well, both Google and Facebook have announced kind of some pandemic initiatives to support local journalism.
Yeah, that's just PR. That is just total BS.
Well, they actually have been buying ads in the local newspapers. That's, I have noticed that.
Not that, yeah, but that's total BS. That's just a short-term make yourself look good. That's like the head of a company saying, I'm not going to take my salary. Yeah, you're worth, you know, you got $80 million in stock options this year. I don't care about your salary.
Well, what I think is very interesting is that they said, you know, I think it was Facebook said $75 million and or $25 million. I can't remember what it was.
Also known as lunch.
Yeah, and then Google came and said, we're going to do $100 million, to which I say, you guys are like billion-dollar organization. And I don't mean, like, you earn profit billions of dollars per quarter. The fact that you're saying, oh, here's you know, some change for you, that doesn't really impress me.
No, it's just one-off. It's not systemic. It's not something they're obligated to do or will be doing consistently because they should be. It's just something they're pretending to do to get good press.
Yes. Well, now, you know, most of the show we've talked about, you know, one form or another.
The death of journalism, the death of newspapers, the death of jobs and at the Hollywood Reporter. Very sad. Oh,
yes. Well, I guess since we're talking about death, let's talk about death in our obituary section. Two very sad deaths. I mean, they're all sad, but I mean, these people I actually knew.
Oh.
Alan Davio was a five-time Oscar nominee, first of all. I can't believe he never won an Oscar.
Well, here's what I wanted to say about that. People always say, oh, it's just an honor to be nominated. It's just an honor to be among this group of five people. And you know what? It's actually true. When you hear about somebody being nominated five times for an Oscar, you go, wow, that's a great career. You don't say, ah, you never won. What a loser. No, that's hugely impressive. He was nominated for E.T., The Color Purple, his masterpiece as a cinematographer, Empire of the Sun, as well as Barry Levinson's Avalon and Bugsy. He also got an ASC Lifetime Achievement Award. That's the American Society of Cinematographers. That is a great career. You don't look at that ever and think for a second, oh, he never won. You know, it's like, no, it's completely awesome. He was a five-time Oscar nominee. That's very impressive. What else did he do?
Well, first of all, he worked with Spielberg from 1968 when he shot the 26-minute short Amblin. Okay, so that was the first thing he did with Spielberg. But he also shot music videos for The Animals and Jimi Hendrix before music videos were music videos.
That's right. I know people who are casting directors and they do favors for people they know or people who are introduced to them, and they decide they like their project. Okay, I'll help you cast your little short. You know, I'm an important person. I work on TV and film and theater, but I'll do your little short. And you know what? It pays off sometimes. I mean, he said, oh, you want me to help you with that short? Okay. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was, you know, he was already a player. He was already active and making money. So that was really him saying, I like this guy. I like what he's doing, or I like the script. And he donated his time essentially to make that short happen and developed a relationship that stood him in damn good stead.
Yeah. Now, you know, I have to say, I worked with Alan Davio very briefly, work is kind of an overstatement. He was going to shoot a project for Saturn Films, Nicolas Cage's production company at the time. This was back in the 90s, and I got to know him then, and he was just very nice, such a cordial person. And then I found out he was my neighbor, but he lived five doors away from me. I thought, oh, how weird is that? And I did not know that he had moved to the Motion Picture Television Fund, the housing for kind of retired professionals. Mm-hmm. And they are right around the corner from me now. I could walk there in maybe 15
minutes. So he's closer?
Minutes.
He moved closer to you?
I moved and he followed
your
me.
House seems, your house is like Howl's Moving Castle. It just seems to go. he's up the block. Everybody in Hollywood is just around the corner from you. I think you're high. Happy 420, by the way.
Well, I will say I had no idea that, you know, look, I don't know any of the people that live there. But what I did learn over the weekend was that they have their own TV channel inside there, inside this little, like, it's like a retirement village.
For what purpose?
To just keep, you know, information flowing into, you know,
like a local public access channel.
Yes, exactly.
Well, how funny. Well, yeah, you'll have to tell me how you know actor Brian Tennehy. He's a 2-time Tony winner. He died at 81. Alan Davio was 77. Brian Denny was currently recurring on NBC's The Blacklist. I watch that show every week. His character has been in a coma, and apparently he will never come out. That was sort of a plot twist on the show. So that's very sad. He is a Tony winner for Death of a Salesman and the show I saw him in, Long Day's Journey into Night. And he had a longtime association with the Goodman Theater in Chicago. He is a major, major theater actor, but he also did a ton of television guest spots, a lot of movies. He broke out in film via First Blood, that Sylvester Stallone movie. And he did everything from Tommy Boy to Cocoon to Silverado to a million other things. Countless TV appearances, from a recurring role on Dynasty to, of course, The Blacklist. So he had 6 Emmy nominations in all. He won 2 Tonys. I was happy enough and lucky enough to see him on stage, though I missed some of his great stuff in Eugene O'Neill. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see The Iceman Cometh. I keep missing that. I don't know why. But a terrific actor who's just been around for decades. If you know the name, when you see him, you'd be like, oh, yes, that's Brian Dennehy.
Well, the reason I know him is because when I was going to school in New York at NYU in the 90s, his daughter actually had an apartment that I stayed in. Yes. Yeah. And so he would, from time to time, he'd be there, you know, very briefly. And so, I mean, look, we weren't hanging out. And at the time he had already done First Blood. He was already pretty well known. I mean, he was an actor where I went, oh, I know you.
And yeah. And he's a great stage actor. And, you know, as we wind up the show, 2 little new bits of information. One, we talked about streaming. Fandango has acquired Walmart's streaming service called Vudu Video, which sounds like you're in Haiti. But anyway, that they have acquired that. So maybe Fandango now wants to beef up its work even more. I shouldn't have made fun of them earlier. And Universal Music Group is saying, yes, we expect, of course, a continued downturn in physical sales. But music labels do not depend on concert biz the way artists and talent agencies do. They are saying their subscription service is a lot more stable and robust. They had a $1.5 billion in recorded music revenue in the first 3 months of 2020, up 13% year to year. Now, we were seeing that streaming numbers were not actually going up for various complicated reasons, but revenue, because you've got your subscription service, that continues to go on. Unless you cancel it, it's happening. So that is continuing. They're up 13% over the first 3 months of 2019. So that's good news for Universal.
And it's good news. We're not canceled. Yes, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, rate and review us, subscribe to us. It does help us out when you do any of those things. You can find those ways to subscribe to us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And we're on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be liked, found, appreciated, followed, whatever the word, the verb
Evans,
is. There.
Evans, okay.
Yes. Well, now, all of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. I would like to thank Kelly McBride from the Poynter Institute for joining us today. We will place links to all of her work in our show notes. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's etphonehome.com. Like, oh, please do phone home because I'm bored and I've talked to all my friends 10 times.
A reference to Alan Davio, yes.
That's right.
Now, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.